Wintrust Business Lunch with John Beaver today, a financial advisor at Phase 3 Advisory Services. John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's good to be here. Always good to talk with you and the audience.
Yeah. Well, you were talking to Pete a little bit about trillion-dollar companies, and I don't know if you're putting something together here, like what do they all have in common, or is there a good or bad thing about trillion-dollar companies? Why are they on your radar?
Well, they're on my radar just because it's something to pay attention to. I'm not saying that they're going to drop in price. I'm not saying that they're not going to, you know, seem like they're going to take over the world. It's just interesting. So it was yesterday that Musk suggests that the size of Tesla may, you know, someday be $25 trillion. I don't doubt that sometime way in the future it'll be $25 trillion. The question is how soon. And, you know, the announcement was really about how he sees there being eventually more robots than human. And so it's a thing to think about because it's a disruptive industry, what's going on with AI. And we've had this before. This is not the first time. We can go back to the late 1800s and how disruptive railroads, think about how disruptive railroads were to the world. Significant internet in the late 1990s. Significant disruption. But what's interesting is each one of those had a huge boom in stock prices followed by quite a few bankruptcies.
Oh, really? Well, we don't remember that as a negative thing, though, right? That's just a consequence of the evolution of industries and the economies, right?
Right, but it is very impactful at the time when those bankruptcies occur because a lot of people are invested in those companies. Right. They lose a lot of money if they're overinvested. The point is, don't allow your portfolio to get over-concentrated into these companies. It's very easy to think, oh, they're going to the moon, and they may go to the moon, but we just don't know, so be careful to not let your portfolio get overweight.
I thought the $25 trillion was the payment package for Elon Musk. Are you sure you've got the right number there?
Yep. The payment package is one issue. This is the other issue. His is not a trillion-dollar package, billions of dollars of package to him. So this is the market value of the companies. You know, right now we're looking in the $3 to $4 trillion mark for these absolutely largest companies. So you're talking Tesla, you know, going up significantly, at least 10, you know, maybe 15 times the current value of the company is how he's projecting it could happen based on how many robots they think they're going to sell. And that was just from Optimus, not anything else that he has in his mind that's cooking
kind
away.
Of a terrifying thing, more robots in the world than human beings. But maybe that shouldn't frighten us, right? It's not like they're going to take over the world. It's simply that we have been able to streamline the workload for human beings by delegating it to machines, right?
Exactly, right. We're just thinking about those movies and end of the world
type
thing.
I know. Well, do you think that the market overall, I mean, I thought you told me there was going to be a correction coming and it hasn't come, John. What's going on here?
There's always a correction coming. Remember that every year you can expect a 10% pullback. That's just normal. That's the market breathing. Every 3 to 5 years you get a 20% pullback. So just never forget that. Don't get lulled into a false sense of security. Now, we had one about a year ago, 10% pullback, July to August. Certainly it's expected again this year, especially with it being an election year. It doesn't have to happen, but we'd be surprised if it didn't. So just be aware of that. So if you've got some money to put into the market right now, maybe you just ease that in over the next 3, 4, 5 months rather than jumping in right at this point in time.
But weren't you also talking about thinking about how to reallocate your assets in your retirement plan, like you've got a target date when you're going to retire and therefore your portfolio sort of changes to more conservative things or into different things? Do you have any advice for us about how we're structuring those or monitoring those?
Yeah, definitely do. And part of this actually relates back to what we were just talking about, and that is the dominance of the largest companies. We're seeing an interesting thing happen in the last month where the S&P 500 cap weight, right, that's the largest companies dominate that index, that's moving up, while at the same time, the S&P 500 equal weight is dropping. So what that means is that the average stock is dropping in price while the handful of these largest companies is going up. That's always something to pay attention to. And how does that relate to your target date fund? Well, most target date funds are somewhat cap weighted, which means you have a very large exposure to the largest companies. And, of course, they can all be run a little bit differently. But here's an interesting thing. The last 2.5 years, the average target date fund for someone retiring in 2035, that 2035 fund, not even up 1% per year. And so as you're getting close to retirement, you want to be aware, because if you go to take a withdrawal, not closing the account, not rolling it over, we're just talking about taking a withdrawal. When you take that withdrawal, you're going to take it pro rata across the whole portfolio. You're going to sell a piece of every fund, or if you have a target date fund, that target date fund is made up of stocks and bonds, international, domestic. You're going to be selling a little piece of each one of those. That might not be the optimal way to take money out.
John was talking a little bit about sort of rethinking how you have structured your retirement plan, so that if you've got it targeted for certain ages and certain assets. John, finish that thought for me now. What was the point you were making, and then what do we do about it?
Yeah, so this really relates to how you take withdrawals. So think about this. You're right on the verge of retirement, or you're in retirement. And let's say that you've got five positions in that. You got like a cash position, a bond position, a U.S. stocks, international stocks, and some other kind of an alternate, real estate or natural resources. And you go to take a withdrawal. What you want to do is you want to take your withdrawal from the strongest performer at that time. That means it's grown to be larger than it should be than the rest of the portfolio based on your targeted allocation. So that withdrawal you take from the one that's grown the most. And you keep doing that. You keep taking, rotating around those areas based on which one's done best. So if the market falls and the bonds are down, but the cash position is going to be stable, then you take the money from there. Well, you can't do that in your 401k. The reason is, when you take a withdrawal from your 401k, they're going to take that withdrawal pro rata from each one of your positions. You're just going to sell across the board. And so in order to control that, you need to have it in something that you have that control over, which would be rolling into an IRA. So what do you do about this if, you're still working, but you want to work towards that? Well, you can take an in-service withdrawal and roll over that portion of it, not all of it, and put a portion of it where you have some control. So sometimes what we do with our clients a couple years before retirement, we'll actually roll over a portion of that 401k into a shorter-term cash position. So when they start taking withdrawals when they retire, if the market's down, they're not locking in losses. They can go to that more conservative position in their IRA. It's just a thought, something for people to think about.
But it sounds like you're talking about maximizing the return on that investment. But what do you say about minimizing the tax on that transaction?
Yeah. So, again, when you do an in-service withdrawal, you're not taking the money out of the plan. You're rolling it to an IRA, and that's a tax-free rollover. Obviously, when you need to start taking income in retirement, you're going to be paying tax on those withdrawals if you're taking it from your pre-tax account. Now, there is another way to work on saving taxes if you have company stock in the plan. And this is something that's called net unrealized appreciation. I won't go into the details right now, but the point is, you can get a pretty neat tax advantage if you roll out the stock. You have to have company stock in the plan. You roll that out. Do not roll it over to your IRA, but you need to work with your financial advisor on this, because the rules are tricky. In fact, I just did one with a client with a very, very large employer here in Illinois. And the plan sponsor got it wrong. And fortunately, we were on top of that. We watched it. We worked with the plan sponsor, said, this is not the way you're supposed to do this. I don't know how they did it wrong, but they did. And it could have cost the client tens of thousands of dollars in taxes. As it is, he's going to save tens of thousands of dollars in taxes by doing it, having it done the right way.
Hmm. Where is your head on the Fed this week?
The Fed, I think they're slightly hawkish. And when we take a look at the data says, yeah, they've got room to do a drop here, but that Fed is waiting for that 2% inflation rate for more than a month or two. So the points are, inflation is getting a little bit better, not very fast. I still have the same opinion I did the last time I was on. I think one rate cut this year. I think it's going to be after the election. I don't think they'll do a September rate cut unless we really get some positive inflation data the next couple of months. And then maybe next year, too. But see, the economy is humming along. The economy is still doing quite well, handling the rates where they're at, which makes us question, where is that neutral rate? Where is that interest rate where everything is stable? My guess is down about 0.5%, maybe 0.75% from where we're at. But they cannot risk a resurgence of inflation. Interesting chart if you compare inflation from 1966 to 1980. To presently, line up 2013 to 1966, the inflation pattern looks the same. Not good news for the next 10 years.
You said that's not good news for the next 10 years?
Right, because it shows that we're on the verge of another uptick, maybe within the next 2 to 3 years in inflation, which would fit the pattern where you have government overspending continuing to inflate and the Fed trying to fight that. That's what we talked about last time.
Yeah, right. But then what kind of numbers are we talking there? What sort of inflation was that?
Well, hopefully nothing like the 1970s, but we might be seeing, you know, the inflation rate might push back up into the 4% range. And again, the Fed's target is 2, and the reason for that is the government debt. They've got to keep the interest rates low on the government debt to keep that debt service low.
Yeah, all things being equal, though, I got 30 seconds here, but if we only had one rate cut this year, what would that do to our retirement accounts? Would that be good for the equities that people are invested in? Would it be neutral? Would it be bad?
I think it'll be neutral. It certainly, you know, won't lend the fire to push the market to even higher levels. That would be
right.
Out of, you know, too far. I think that would be the right policy at this point in time, because again, inflation hasn't reached the Fed's target yet.
That's a John Beaver. By the way, John, I didn't know this. You host a podcast. Did I see that as well?
Yeah, we do. It's called The Year You Retire. A lot of good ideas in there for people approaching retirement. A lot of the things that we've just talked about, we go into more detail. So it's a lot of fun, called The Year You Retire with myself and Jim Uren.
Okay, that's John Beaver, financial advisor at Phase 3 Advisory Services. We'll talk again. Thank you, John.
You bet. Bye-bye.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN, where we talk about the big picture stuff, as we did a little while ago with John Beaver about the markets and interest rates. We also talk about the sort of local level, the retail level. Let's learn about another business in the Chicago area. Here's Nicole Flores, who is a partner at Chicago's Pizza, the daughter of the founder, Martin Flores, too. Nicole, you're on the air. How are you?
Hi, John. How are you? I'm doing well. Thanks for having us.
Now, I hear some noise in the background. Where are you? Are you at work right now?
I am in the office. Yeah, I'm at the Chicago's Pizza office right now.
So Chicago's Pizza is the name of 3 restaurants on the north side of the city, right?
That is correct. We have 3 currently. We started in 1991 in our original single location on Sheffield and Wellington.
And I wonder, I was thinking about that. I wonder if, like, what a great business to be in Chicago, selling pizza. But then I thought, no, that's got to be the most difficult business in Chicago because there's because it's so competitive. Talk about how easy or difficult it is to make a name for yourself selling pizza in this town.
You know, I definitely think now it's way more saturated than it was before. We have conversations with my dad consistently. We used to be open until 5 in the morning. So we had something unique that drew people in on top of, you know, having a commissary and a home, not a home kitchen, but a scratch kitchen. So we, although we have 3 locations, we have a commissary where we make our dough. We have 4 separate doughs. We have 2 different pizza sauces. We also make our dressings in-house. So having quality food is important, something that stands out. And as I said, now it's a much more saturated market. So we're even rethinking how we do marketing. And that includes email marketing, which brings into play third-party apps, which we don't always own that information. So we don't always have access to that. So it's definitely thinking outside of the box, staying on top of things in regards to marketing, but really just honing in on what we do really, really well, which is our pizza, our scratch kitchen, making sure everything is made consistently across all 3 restaurants.
You don't use third-party apps for delivery, do you? You have your own drivers delivering the pizza?
So we do both. We do third-party apps, but we encourage our customers to order direct. We have drivers. We partner with a company to ensure that we have in-house drivers, so we are able to control the user experience. When you order from us and you order direct, we handle everything. So there's no need to go through third parties. We know when your driver gets here, when they're sent out for deliveries, the anticipated time of arrival. So we do have a good amount of drivers that work with us and have been with us for some time. But like I said, we also do use third-party apps just because sometimes it feels like you need to.
Why do you mean that?
Often with getting new customers. I feel like third-party apps are a really good way to acquire new customers. The only hurdle then is that, like I said, we don't own their information. So they're not necessarily our customers. So once you've experienced us once, we do try to send marketing materials with your orders from there. So if you're picking up, we're sending you information. If you're with delivery, we're sending you menus. And try to push you and nudge you. Like, next time, order from us directly. Here are some coupons to use directly through us. So we definitely incentivize the ordering direct.
Does the third party delivery service know that inside the pizza box it says, don't use these guys anymore, use us?
It doesn't necessarily say don't use them. It just says use us direct next time, you know? So, and I mean, I think everyone does it, right? What other way do we have to market those customers that come through a third party app? We don't have access to their information. We can't email them. So it's really the only option that we have.
You mentioned four different kinds of crust, two different kinds of sauces, and I understand that one of the keys for you all is that, as you said, everything is made from scratch at one location. Is that right? You described it as your commissary?
Yeah, that's correct. So while we have three restaurants, we also have an additional location, which are usually we open around 4 in the morning, and we make our dough daily, our sauce daily, our dressings, our soups, a variety of what we have in-house here at our restaurants.
Wow. Bakeries open in the middle of the night. You guys are in there at 4 in the morning?
Yeah, that's right.
How many employees do you all have now? You said you started out with one location. It's a family business. How big have you grown?
We have about 100 employees across all three locations, all four locations, so including our commissary as well.
Do you have a flavor or a kind of pizza that you're known for? Are you thick or thin? Are you spicy or sweet? What's your deal?
Ooh, good question. So we do our deep dish stuffed crust that we're known for. It is it's thick, it's cheesy, and then we have, you know, our dedicated pizza sauce for that style of our stuffed crust. So we have different pizza sauce for our thin crust and our stuffed crust. So the sauce as well has a lot of spices mixed into it itself, and it's delicious.
I like the name of the place, too. I mean, Chicago's Pizza, I'm surprised that was available as recently as the 1990s. Chicago's known for pizza. What a good name to have, Chicago's Pizza. Or maybe that's too generic. I don't know. What value do you place on the name of your restaurants?
It's all about branding, right? And we really do think that we offer quality pizza. We've been a staple in the Northside neighborhood. And with that, I think we're at a place where we can say, hey, we are Chicago's Pizza. We are a staple in the Northside neighborhood. And we have the pizza that you're looking for. When you come to Chicago, and we often do get a lot of visitors who come in, not just to try our stuffed crust, but to also try our gluten-free crust. Our gluten-free is really popular in the gluten-free community. So we get various visitors come in. So at this point, I feel like the branding worked, and now we're trying to do another 30 years with the next generation coming in to continue that name and expand that brand and really continue to put Chicago's Pizza on the map.
Are you going to march south? Are you going to expand your borders a little bit?
That has been a topic of conversation for my cousin, my brother, and I. We're definitely considering other locations. Right now, we're focused on some remodeling that we're doing on our current locations. We're definitely keeping our eye on expanding, going south, downtown, maybe even the suburbs. Definitely something we are discussing.
And one last thing, Nicole. So this was a question we would always ask businesses like yours 2 years ago. I don't find myself asking it so much anymore, but how is staffing for you guys? How hard is it to get and keep employees?
Ooh, good question. So we do have our loyal employees who've been with us for so long. We're a family-owned restaurant, so of course we've got, you know, my family, the Flores family, but we have a number of employees who have been with us for years. For example, the cook who started with us in 1991, he is still here with us today. His brother is still here with us today. So we do have a good core of employees who continue with us year over year. But we do still have with, you know, wait staff front of house. Sometimes that is a bit more difficult. We actually just hired. We got really lucky. The summer usually is a good time for hiring. So we did just find some staff for our restaurant, which we're remodeling and reopening in just a couple weeks. And so we've had good luck so far, I would say.
Yeah. So you're dine in and carry out. What's the percentage of each?
So the bulk of our revenue comes from delivery. 75% is deliveries. And yeah, then the next from there would be about 15% carry out and then dining room.
Got it. A lot of time. Mm-hmm. Three locations. What are the addresses of your restaurants?
Yeah, we've got one in Lakeview, so 3114 North Lincoln. We've got another one in Ravenswood, so that is going to be 1919 West Montrose. And then we have one in Old Irving, 4520 West Irving Park.
I'm hungry. This sounds really good, Nicole. Congratulations. Continued success. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John. I hope you have a good day.
Yeah, you too. Nicole Flores is a partner at Chicago's Pizza on the north side. More business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. You and your pooch can travel together in style on a new airline catering to dogs and their owners. Bark Air launched in May and will expand later this year to include Chicago's Midway Airport. The airline uses Gulfstream G5 aircraft, and a first-class ticket comes with calming treats, scented towels, music, and beverages, including chicken broth for your dog. Dogs can roam freely on the planes. The airline launched with flights connecting New York and Los Angeles, but has expanded to other cities. In October, Bark Air will launch at Midway with flights to and from Miami, New York, Phoenix, and San Jose. A single ticket includes travel for one dog and one human and costs $6,000. Bark Air says that price will come down as it expands. The Chicago Tribune is moving its newsroom to the West Loop. Cranes reports the Tribune is leased 3,700 square feet in the 12-story building at 233 West Jackson. Editorial operations will move there July 1st. Terms of the lease haven't been disclosed. The newspaper is moving its newsroom and printing operations from the Freedom Center, which is being replaced by a new casino complex. Printing is being moved to Schaumburg. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Here's the business of food now with Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you, and it's a Mr. Fizz Friday, but first let's play a little Name That Tune. Here's a hint, if you need it. 1988, that year is on gardening guru Jim Fizzell's mind, and he'll talk about that after I thank the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Okay, Jim, 1988?
Well, first of all, hi, Steve. It's a wonderful time of year. 1988 was a year that started out normally, and suddenly the rain stopped and the heat came on, and for several weeks in a row, temperatures hit the 90s with absolutely no rain. We had problems with crops out in the field. Actually, I remember driving up to Hebron along Route 47 one afternoon. I noticed one of the cornfields on the right-hand side of the road was on fire. Now, for a cornfield to be on fire, it's rather unusual, but it was so dry. The other thing that I can recall is I remember that was the year that we changed Soldier Field to grass. And that was the year that we needed irrigation in the worst way. But we had a lot of complaints from people. Why can't we use water when you're using water on that new grass at Soldier Field? Well, it was either that or lose the grass altogether. But they did have watering bans throughout this area, watering the trees and so forth. It was a terrible time. But that's the story of 1988. Actually, you know, this is really a wonderful time of year. I started to mention that. It's Rose Month. It's Dairy Month. Today is Flag Day. Sunday is Father's Day. A couple of thoughts. First of all, for dads on Father's Day, you might get them gift certificates to the hardware store or the garden center or a membership in Morton Arboretum or the Botanic Garden. You can also get small garden tools. They're always appreciated because you lose them or break them or replace them. And then how about an awning so he can sit outdoors? When he's sitting out there enjoying life, you can get him some fresh strawberry rhubarb pie from the farmer's market and a glass of good cold milk from our Midwest dairy farmers and enjoy the day along with him. Be sure you keep it safe.
Will do. Mr. Fizz, Jim Fizzell, our gardening guru. And back to Name That Tune. If you didn't get it, here's another clue. The number one song of 1988. On the food calendar, today's National Strawberry Shortcake Day, National Cucumber Day, and National Bourbon Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Jeff Ostrowski joins us now, an analyst over at Bankrate, about the hidden costs of home ownership, state by state. Jeff, what are we talking about here? What do you define as hidden costs of home ownership?
Well, these are the ongoing costs that you get the privilege of paying when you buy a house. So I think everyone buys a house, first-time buyers especially, and they're sort of focused on the price of the home, how much they need to scrape together for a down payment, whether they can qualify for the mortgage payment. And so everyone's kind of focused on the principal and interest and the price. But our research finds that the ongoing costs of keeping a house standing and safe and clean is $18,000 a year nationally.
So are you including in the $18,000 a year nationally insurance and taxes?
Yep. Yeah, but property taxes, property insurance, power bills, cable and internet. But the biggest factor is just ongoing maintenance and repairs. And so for most homeowners, that's the biggest factor. Illinois is at about $16,000 a year, which is a bit below the national average. So not a huge surprise there. Property insurance is fairly affordable in Illinois. Property taxes are a little bit higher than the national average. But a lot of these costs are just a function of the price of the home. And because the home prices in the Midwest aren't as high as they are on the coasts, those ongoing costs aren't as high in Illinois as they are in other parts of the country.
I see. I'm going to guess. Well, I wouldn't know then, because Hawaii is an expensive place to own the home, but the weather's kind of moderate there. I was thinking maybe the weather would be a factor because it just beats up your house. Where are the most expensive places to own a home in terms of maintenance costs and ownership?
Well, you nailed the first one. The most expensive is Hawaii. Second most expensive is California. So probably no surprise there, just because those are the two of the highest cost housing markets in the country. And then the other states in the top five were New Jersey, Massachusetts, Connecticut. And those states were all in the top five because they have very high property taxes. So the average property tax bill in New Jersey is $10,000 now. And so it's kind of a mix of factors. Then there are some states, since you mentioned the weather, places like Florida, Texas, California, homeowners insurance has gotten much more expensive as carriers start to absorb the costs of natural disasters and then factor that into their future projections.
Yeah, I wonder about that. I don't know how those people do it. I know some of them are self-insuring or not insuring. If you own the house outright, I guess you can do that. But that has to be a concern for people in Florida.
Yeah. Florida is kind of an interesting case. I mean, ever since Hurricane Andrew hit back in the early 90s, the Florida property insurance market has been a disaster. A lot of the big carriers have pulled back or pulled out. So State Farm and Allstate were the biggest carriers there. That's no longer the case. And the state of Florida and Florida property owners have adapted somewhat. The building codes are much stricter now. Homes are hardened against hurricanes. But yes, as you pointed out, it's not cheap to insure a property in Florida. And California is kind of going that same direction. The mainstream big carriers have started to pull back or pull out of California as well.
It's not just happening in coastal states, but even in states in the Midwest, too. Jeff Ostrowski is an analyst over at Bankrate.com. It's a very interesting and helpful chart. You'll see where, what do you know, Illinois is at least in the middle of the pack, and then the writing all about it. That's at Bankrate.com. Jeff, it's nice to talk to you. Thanks for the insight today.
All right. Thanks, John.